This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm only going to be talking about three movies this week, which are Gods of Egypt, Eddie the Eagle, and Triple Nine. And that is because I'm also going to be talking about the Oscars, which is this weekend, Sunday night. So I'm going to give my surefire, not to ever be outdone or wrong, Oscar predictions. And you can check them against the winners on Sunday night and take that all the way to the bank. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and a listener question, which is kind of interesting, a bit of a math geek question, and then the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And of course, you can always find me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The big news this week is all about Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice. This is coming out in just a couple weeks. DC and Warner Brothers have been hyping this for a year, quite literally. On Monday, I believe, you can start buying early tickets, and they come with like additional books and packages. I mean, they're really trying to hype this up, which they need to do because they don't have the benefit that Marvel did of having five other movies preceding it in the theaters. They only had one, which is Man of Steel. Warner Brothers is putting a lot behind this movie, so, you know, we'll see what happens. Now, the big news that came out, probably the biggest news, is that the director's cut, I think it's interesting they're already calling it the director's cut, they submitted a cut to the MPAA and got an R rating, and they said, this is going to be the director's cut. This is what's going to be on the Blu-ray and DVD when it comes out. Similar to what happened with The Hobbit. If you remember the third movie in The Hobbit series, they had a director's cut. The extended version had an R rating to it, and it had an R rating to it because of just really one sequence, which had a lot of blood and decapitations. It was a very graphic scene. Nothing else was really added to anything else in the third Hobbit movie for the extended edition. So I'm assuming there's going to be just additional graphic content in Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice for the Blu-ray. That's not what it's going to be in the theaters. It's already a 2.5-hour movie as it is in the theaters. Now, is this good or bad? Well, I don't know. It's good if it's necessary. I mean, if this is the movie that needed to be made, then that's good. To me, rating should not be aiming for, you make the movie that needs to be made and you get the rating that you need to. Of course, in Hollywood, if you put $300 million behind a movie, you want to get as wide of audience as possible. And generally, PG-13 is what's going to get you the widest audience possible, because you tend to make it harder for the kiddies to see a movie. And it's a Superman and Batman movie, so you want the kids to go see it. Now, it's bad if it's not necessary to have this cut. And the whole point is that if all this is an extra 10 minutes of fighting, and just maybe you see innocent people getting killed or blown up or blood or decapitations or something like that, if it's just graphic for graphic's sake, then no, it's not necessary, and then it's bad. And I don't even know if this is in response to Deadpool's success, because this is a cut that they had already submitted. It's not like they rushed this cut to the MPAA on Monday. I don't know, an R rating for these movies, I've always said that the DC movies are getting a little grim. But then again, it could also just have a scene where Batman says, you know, a couple F-bombs, and then that'll get it an R rating. You can have one F-bomb in a movie, and it can't be used in a sexual context, and that'll let you do PG-13. But once it's used in a sexual context, or you have more than one, then it's an R rating, and that could be all it is. Don't read too much into this. Now, the other thing that sort of dovetails into this and is Justice League news. Zack Snyder said they already have an April filming date for Justice League Part 1, and of course he's directing it. Now, the thing that always bothers me about this is this would be the third movie they've got Zack Snyder directing in this DC universe, and none of them have come out from any other directors. Now, if you recall what happened in the Marvel universe, Iron Man was directed by Jon Favreau. He did Iron Man 2, and a lot of people saw that as a disappointment and a step down because he was overloaded with studio notes. Same thing with Joss Whedon doing Avengers and Avengers Age of Ultron weighted down. We'll see if that's what happened to the brothers who directed Winter Soldier, if they're weighted down for Civil War coming out. But, you know, maybe it's not a good idea to have it all resting in one man's hands. They're really putting all their eggs in one basket. And, of course, that begs a question that I've been saying for months. What if Batman versus Superman isn't a monster hit? Say it's a hit. Say it does well. But say it's not a movie that makes $1.5 billion worldwide. What if it just does like Man of Steel business or a little bit less? What if it's not like The Dark Knight? Then they got to figure out what's happening. And just because there's an April start date, if the Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice opening weekend is not up to what Warner Brothers wants, they're going to be doing some changes, and that start date might change. Also, the other thing I find interesting about this is they're keeping the Justice League Part 1 title, at least right now. That whole Part 1, Part 2 thing was very cool back when they did it with Harry Potter and they did it with the Twilight movies. That's starting to cause problems in releases. If you look at what happened to Mockingjay, Mockingjay Part 1 and 2, Part 2 was seen as a greedy cash grab and it lost significant audience. And already they've changed the last Divergent title to Allegiant and Ascendant, even though it's a Part 1 and Part 2. They've taken that Part 1 and Part 2. We'll see if they keep the Part 1 and Part 2. We'll see if the Avengers Infinity War keeps Part 1 and Part 2. That 1-2 punch might not work as well now after people have kind of said, well, now you're just trying to milk stuff. Even though the Justice League and the Avengers movies, you can do whatever you want to. You're not adapting from an actual source material, an actual book. If it works as a two-part movie, like Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi as a two-part movie, then it works as Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions. That was a two-part movie, and you could do it. It didn't feel like you needed to have them all in one. So the Hobbit is another one that showed a loss of box office as they went through a book that's been broken up too many ways. The final piece of news, and this is just a little bit of a note, is Pacific Rim 2 is going to be directed by Daredevil showrunner Steven DeKnight. And that just disappoints me because I wanted to see Guillermo del Toro do it. I like Guillermo del Toro's work, and I think he was the heart and soul of Pacific Rim. We'll see if he can make Pacific Rim 2 work under a different director. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Hardcore Henry, opens on April 8th, and the most interesting thing, which you can't see in this because it's obviously radio, is it's a first-person point-of-view movie.
Henry, fight back! You're capable of more than you think!
It's all right, I'm here to help you. Is your speech module installed? But at least we know you're not deaf. Okay, well the good news is that you're going to live a while. The bad news is there's an army standing between you and your wife. So let's go get her.
This looks like it might have some killer action sequences in it. It looks like it's going to be a lot of high energy and a lot of cool stuff happening. The only thing that worries me about this is the first-person POV shot. It's shot like a Doom video game. And that's neat for like a sequence. I don't know if you can do a whole movie about this. The only times I've seen movies like this is, you know, Son of Saul, which is an award film, but it's not quite POV, but it's all kind of like it's right by his head the whole time. The camera's on him almost entirely. Or something like The Bell Jar and the Butterfly, that one about the guy who, it was all from his point of view because he could only move his eyes. But that was actually very contained. Action movie, first person point of view, you might throw up in an IMAX theater. We'll see what happens. It looks like a neat movie, but who knows? The next one I want to talk about is Pete's Dragon. This is, of course, a remake of the 70s Disney film. Opens on August 12th.
Guess you heard about the boy.
You know, word travels in this town. How long has he been out there?
6 years.
You don't survive in a forest for 6 years alone.
He says he wasn't alone.
This is clearly going for a more somber, intense, scary kind of movie. You know, still, I'm assuming it's going to be a PG and lighted movie that has a lot of Disney hope and sweetness to it. But I mean, it's a big difference between an Ink and Pate Elliott, Big Fat Dragon. Go back and watch Pete's Dragon, the original drags a bit, and you know, you've got Shelley Winters in there, and they have these lighthearted, fun songs about child slavery, which are really bizarre. It's time to update the movie. I'm just wondering if they're straying a little bit too far from the path, because this looks nothing like the original Pete's Dragon. That's it for the segment. I got to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Gods of Egypt and Triple Nine. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, heading into the movie reviews for this week. We've only got three, but we're going to hit two of them right now. The first one is Gods of Egypt. A bunch of white actors play Egyptian gods who mix it up with the mortals as they fight for control of the world.
Egypt has always been a paradise. But now there's chaos.
Soon I will rule all of the world.
My legions of the desert will bring them reckoning!
You have the power to make this right.
So how do we stop him?
Try to keep up.
What's funny is if you listen to the general buzz of politically correct Hollywood and politically correct journalists, the biggest sin this movie commits is it whitewashes the characters, which, first of all, fine, that's true. It is mostly a bunch of white actors. Although you have Chadwick Boseman playing the god of wisdom, and he does a terrible job. I mean, if he's not doing a biopic of somebody like James Brown or Jackie Robinson, he apparently is terrible. And I hope he gets his accent straightened out before he plays Black Panther in the Marvel movie, because it's kind of ridiculous, his performance. But yeah, I mean, the big controversy is over the whitewashing of this. And we saw the same thing happen when they were casting, like people like Joel Edgerton and Christian Bale as Egyptians and Hebrews in Exodus, Gods and Kings, which is kind of a tradition in Hollywood. I mean, going back to stuff like Ben-Hur, there was always white people playing Egyptians. Now it's just politically incorrect to do that. That's not the problem with this movie. It's the same thing that happened with Pan. People lashed out at Pan because you cast Rooney Mara, a white woman, as Tiger Lily. And they really, you're telling me that if you cast a Native American person as Tiger Lily, it wouldn't be a racist role. I mean, that's the kind of role that that was. The problem with Gods of Egypt isn't that it cast white people. It's that it cast people that aren't really movie stars as the movie stars. Gerard Butler's really the only recognizable name in it, and he's Scottish. He walks around the movie with this thick Scottish accent as an Egyptian god. It kind of is ridiculous. And I don't know how this movie got all these people thrown into a $140 million budgeted film without any recognizable face or name to put butts in the seats. And if you had had somebody black or white in these roles, it might be a bigger draw. Director Alex Proyas, at one time, was one of the most fascinating directors out there. I mean, going back to the 90s, he did stuff like The Crow and Dark City. If you haven't seen Dark City, it's one of the best, well, I'd say modern, but it's like 20 years old, the best sci-fi brilliant film. It's absolutely worth seeing. And I even liked his movies like Knowing, and iRobot was okay for what it was. I think it was kind of ruined with Will Smith. But Alex Proyas is actually a native Egyptian. I mean, he's a white guy from Australia, but he was born in Egypt, which is sort of as racially inclusive as pointing out that Charlize Theron was the first African to ever win an Academy Award for Best Actress because she's South African. And I mean, even though she's white, she is still technically, she's an African. So it is a little bit murky when you start trying to point out and say, well, this guy's Egyptian or this guy isn't. The bottom line, these are gods. It could have been really played by anybody of color or not. It's just, they're not very compelling people. And that's the biggest problem with this film. It's sort of like a Clash of the Titans for Egyptian mythology. And none of the people in here are really all that compelling, but it's cool to watch because it is a huge special effects extravaganza. There's a lot of action. There's a lot of cool things to see. It's just the actors aren't terribly compelling at all. Gerard Butler's the most interesting of the group. Oh, Jeffrey Rush has an interesting part as Ra, but he's very small in this movie. It's not a terribly large role. But it is sort of a ludicrous old Hollywood premise. But, you know, I got to say, I didn't hate it. I wasn't necessarily bored. When I got bored, it was just it ran too long at times. But overall, I found it weirdly entertaining. Maybe that's just because I like Alex Proyas' stuff, even his crap. I thought Knowing was actually pretty good. And iRobot was watchable to a degree, and the only thing that makes that not work is Will Smith. So this movie is way better than, like, Wrath of the Titans. I wouldn't call it a good movie, but I enjoyed it. So I'm going to have to say that it kind of rocks, simply because I didn't hate it. That's going to be on the DVD, I think. I didn't hate it, Kevin Carr, Fat Guys at the Movies.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk real quickly about 999, or as I like to call it, 011-8999-88199-911-97253. If you get that reference, send me an email at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. And the first person to explain that reference, not as the police code of Officer Down, I'll send you a Blu-ray. So yeah, just shoot me an email at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies and see if you're the first person to explain why that joke works. Anyways, 999 is about a group of corrupt policemen who work with criminals to pull off a heist for the Russian Jewish mob, planning to kill a police officer in the process.
Let's make this one for the books.
Call just went out. 2.5 minutes.
What you got for me?
Are we dealing with the four-man team?
They got pictures of my family. Be careful what you inch to Google tweet page.
This guy's the leader.
You gotta ask yourself, who's that fourth guy?
Don't make me regret pulling you cops in for this.
This is one of those nitty-gritty, dark, and underbelly of the crime world movies that we've seen before. Now, a lot of people reference Heat, but this feels a lot more like something like Street Kings or Sabotage. You remember that movie a couple of years ago with Arnold Schwarzenegger, directed by David Ayers, who's doing the Suicide Squad movie? 999 is so sleazy of a movie with such skeezy characters that I felt like I needed a shower after seeing it. I mean, seriously, Norman Reedus is in this movie. Has this guy showered since he started working on The Walking Dead? I mean, the guy looks like he rolled in a vat of used vegetable oil out of the fryers in a Chinese restaurant. This is how just drippy and gross this guy is. And it's got a great cast. Aaron Paul, who's fantastic from Breaking Bad, and Chiwetel Ejiofor, and you've got Kate Winslet in here, you've got Casey Affleck. It's a great cast, but it is a terrible movie. And the reason it's terrible is mainly because there's not a single likable character in the entire film. Even the good guys are terrible, and the internal logic of the movie does not play out. There are things that the criminals and the cops do that I found myself sitting there thinking, well, that's ridiculous. How can the fat guy who watches movies for a living know that that wouldn't work? You're not even playing by bad cop movie standards in this one. The things people try, the weird rules that they live by, the coincidences, and the fact, like, finally when they call in this 999, this 999 with the code where an officer's down, people are going so bonkers. You're like, no, really, seriously, if it's that easy to distract the police, you'd have this stuff going on all the time. And I hated the character so much, I couldn't care less what happened to anybody, good or bad. It is overly grim. It's overwritten to the point that you don't understand what they're actually trying to do at a certain point. It doesn't work as a film in any respect. It's literally one of the worst movies I've seen this year. Now, granted, we're only, you know, less than 2 months in, but it's going to be in contention for one of the worst movies of 2016. So I'm going to have to say 999 totally sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Oscar predictions on Fat Guys at the Movies. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare.
In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, taking a quick break from the reviewing of the films to actually talk about one of the biggest nights in Hollywood, and that is the Oscars, which is on Sunday night, hosted by Chris Rock, the only black guy who's going to be on stage. Oscar's so white. Anyways, I have a love-hate relationship with the Oscars because, I mean, while I enjoy seeing sort of the Super Bowl of Hollywood, it's also a little bit... By the time you're at this, you know, February, late February, even early March, you're just kind of tired of these movies. They came out months ago, and I'm looking forward to stuff like Batman versus Superman and seeing the big blockbusters that are coming out this summer. It just seems a little late now, but it's still neat to see movies that I liked if they end up winning. Like, I loved Spotlight. I don't think it's going to win. I'm just going to run through a couple of them. I'm not going to give, you know, all of my picks, and I'm not going to read all the nominees because, you know, no one wants to hear all that, but just sort of some of the things that I'm looking for as winners this weekend. The first one I want to hit is documentary. A lot of people always forget documentary, and there's some good stuff in there. Personally, I would have picked Cartel Land. I know a lot of people like The Look of Silence. I thought that was not nearly as powerful as The Act of Killing. But I think the one that's going to win is Amy, which is, of course, a documentary about Amy Winehouse. It's a good documentary. It's well done. It's a little bit overly irreverent to her and at times paints itself in a corner as to what its purpose is. But it's a well-done documentary, and it's getting a lot of buzz. It got a lot of buzz when it came out this summer. That's the one I think that the Academy wants to give it to. In terms of foreign films, I know a lot of people out there, you know, don't really follow the foreign films. I don't see all of them. I usually try and see as many as I can when the Oscars are actually upon us. But this is one that is getting a lot of buzz, and that is Son of Saul. I think that one is actually going to win. I had a filmmaker once make a comment to me, gosh, 15 years ago, back when I was doing filmmaking. And he said, well, the easy win is always the Holocaust movie. And I mean, that's the Son of Saul is a Holocaust movie, but it's also very powerful. It's this point of view of this guy who works in the concentration camps at Auschwitz, leading people into the gas chambers and cleaning up after them. It's unnerving and unsettling and a unique approach to a topic that we've seen a lot of. So that's what I think is going to win foreign film. Now, the next one I want to hit is Best Animated Film. One of my favorite things is animation. If you've listened to the show long enough, if you've read my reviews, you know I love animation. I always end up with animated films in my top 10 list. One of them from my top 10 list is nominated, and that would be Shaun the Sheep movie, which is a charming, wonderful British movie. It's not going to win, though. The easy one is Inside Out. I mean, Pixar always walks away with these movies. And even though there's When Marnie Was There, which is a Ghibli movie, a Studio Ghibli movie, it's not as high on the radar as something like Spirited Away when it came out. And you know, Boy in the World is neat, and Anomalisa is different. But the one, Inside Out is just, it's just got so much love for the Academy, and it's Pixar doing its out-of-the-box, bizarre, different stuff, and it came out in the same year that The Good Dinosaur did not get a nomination, even though it's a charming little movie, but Inside Out cleans up for it. So that's what I think is going to win Best Animated Film. Now, the interesting ones are the screenplays. Screenplays are always interesting because they can sometimes break with the Best Picture nominees, but they can also be their own category as well. And when it comes to the original screenplay, I think Spotlight's going to win. That's one of my favorite movies of last year. It's a very well done movie. I mean, Bridge of Spies is good, Ex Machina, and Inside Out as well. I think Straight Outta Compton has a chance, and there might be some guilt that pushes that there because that's the only really African American nominees that are there. So Straight Outta Compton could win Best Screenplay, but I'm going to put my money on Spotlight. Now, in terms of adapted screenplay, the one that I think is going to win is The Big Short, I think for political reasons a lot, but I also think that it was one that came out late enough and got enough buzz, and it's a good enough movie, and it's odd that it's directed by Adam McKay, who does not do this kind of comedy. He does comedy, but not this kind of comedy.
So I think that The Big Short is the one that's going to beat the other ones. You know, like Martian is good, but you know, Room, Carol, Brooklyn, these are all good movies and good screenplays. But I really think the buzz has built for The Big Short, and that's what's going to win adapted screenplay. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's push on through the Oscar nominations. Now, I'm going to talk about the Best Picture first, and there's a reason I'm hitting that one first, because I always wait to the end, but there's great movies, all eight of them, but I think the one that it's to lose, I heard somebody say to me once, so is The Revenant the Donald Trump of this Oscars? And I'm like, yeah, maybe it is. It's The Revenant's to lose. I think The Revenant's going to get Best Picture. I think it's the one that has the most momentum, has the most buzz, and has people's eyes on it as much. If this had ceremony had taken place 2 months ago, heck, it might have been The Big Short or even Bridge of Spies or The Martian. But no, I think it's going to be The Revenant.
What happened?
We did what we had to do.
He was buried right.
All I had was my boy. And he took him from me, you understand? He knows how far I came to find them.
And with that, it's also going to be Leonardo DiCaprio's year. I think for the best actor, he's going to get a chance to not just smile and clap this year. He's actually going to win actor in a leading role, not just because he does a fantastic job in The Revenant, but also because the field isn't as strong. I mean, Matt Damon, Bryan Cranston, Michael Fassbender, Eddie Redmayne, none of them are the wow performances that are the walk away with the award performances, like Eddie Redmayne was last year. Now, Best Actress, I think it is a walk away for Brie Larson for Room. I mean, I love Cate Blanchett and Jennifer Lawrence, Charlotte Rampling, and Saoirse Ronan. They're all great actresses. But Brie Larson has been picking up wins here and there, left and right. This is as in the bag as it can get. Now, it's a little dicier with the Best Supporting Actor and Actress, because I think the Best Supporting Actor, there's a lot of good people out there, and while it seemed to be Mark Rylance's, Sylvester Stallone, I think, is going to get it, because I think the Academy wants to give it to him. I mean, he won an Oscar for Rocky for writing it back in, 1976? But he's never got an acting Oscar, and he never will outside of this. This is his one shot to get it, and he's old, and generally that tends to be the deciding factor for somebody you know, who's been in the business for so long. I mean, Mark Rylance has been as well, but he's not as high profile as Stallone. I think Stallone's going to get it for Creed. And then, of course, supporting actress, that one's way up in the air. That's sort of a horse race for anybody. I mean, I'd love to see Jennifer Jason Leigh get it for The Hateful Eight. That would be my choice. And as much as I like Alicia Vikander, I think I would choose Jennifer Jason Leigh above her. But I think Vikander's going to walk away with it for The Danish Girl. And the reason was is because The Danish Girl was a movie that was meant to be a starring vehicle for Eddie Redmayne. It was meant to be his movie. And the other girl got it. She steals the show in every scene she's in. She is fantastic in this movie. The movie's mostly about her. Really should be a Best Actress nominee, but because it's Best Supporting Actress, that's what they went for. I think she's going to win this one. Finally, and you notice I left the director off for a while, and I'm going to put that in here because I think somebody else is going to get Best Director, partly because Alejandro Iñárritu directed The Revenant. It's extremely rare for a director to win 2 years in a row. He won last year for Birdman. The Academy knows this. They're very sensitive to that sort of thing. So I think what's going to end up happening is you're going to see a split. And while some of the other people did a great job, there's somebody that they want to give this to for a very specific movie that is going to clean up in technical awards, but not going to get the Best Picture.
In this wasteland, I am the one who runs from both the living and the dead. A man reduced to a single instinct. Survive.
Where is she taking them? I want them back! They're my property!
Oh, what a day! What a lovely day!
That's right, George Miller from Mad Max Fury Road, and he deserves it. While I've been critical at times for Mad Max, I didn't think it was the greatest movie of the year, and it does not deserve Best Movie of the Year by anybody. I think as a directing spotlight, it's amazing. And George Miller did a great job with that. He comes back from Happy Feet to do this. This was an amazing feat of directing. you know, say what you want to about the story and the characters, and he would deserve it. I hope that George Miller gets it for Mad Max Fury Road. That's my take on the Oscars. When I come back, I'm going to do the final review of Eddie the Eagle, answer a listener's question, go to the box office, and do the home cinema roundup.
Shake that.
There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies just finished up the Oscar bath, and now I'm going to jump into the movie reviews again. We've got one more movie to talk about, and that is Eddie the Eagle. An awkward skier from Britain finds a way to become an Olympian in the ski jump at the Calgary Olympics in 1988.
Britain hasn't had a ski jumper since 1929.
I'm going to be a ski jumper.
He's going to break his neck.
The time to start jumping is when you're 5 or 6.
You want your moment, Eddie? You gotta do this for real.
Our strategy will best be described as ugly but effective.
The Olympics is associated with certain qualities, excellence, achievement. They have no desire to associate with defeat.
You're a disgrace to the sport.
Good.
This is a sweet movie. This is a well-done movie, and it is a surprising movie because I went and saw this knowing zero about it, which is fun to do now and then. It's so strange for a normal person to do this, but for somebody like me, who sees movies all the time, this is an option to know nothing about a movie and then go see it and be surprised because I have to see it anyways. It's an inspirational movie. It is the Rudy of Olympic ski jumping, and it's very inspirational, has some good performances. Taron Egerton, who plays Eddie Edwards, Eddie the Eagle, I didn't even know that was him. He played in Kingsman last year. And his is completely against the character type he was. He's kind of a nerd, weird, these thick glasses and, you know, very awkward. Whereas in Kingsman, he was very slick. Even when he was an unrefined street thug, he still was a good looking kid. And then he became, you know, of course, a gentleman spy in Kingsman. So it is him breaking from his role, really doing an immersive acting. I keep your eye on him because if he keeps doing this, he could become somebody like a Johnny Depp, where he's mostly interested in doing roles that are different and not wanting to just do, you know, the Faceman roles. Speaking of Faceman, Hugh Jackman's in it. Jackman does a pretty good job in this. I mean, it's again him, you know, using his good looks and chewing on a cigar and drinking bourbon all the time. He channels Wolverine or he channels Logan, but he just doesn't pull out any claws in this. But it's a very different movie than what you'd expect. It's very charming, very sweet, lovable. It's one of those inspirational sports movies that work. And it's just odd that it's about ski jumping. Nobody knows that it's about ski jumping. It's the most strange subject you'd make a movie out of, but it works. So I'm going to say Eddie the Eagle rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about a listener question. This comes from David from Nebraska. Now, he sent me this rather lengthy email. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he essentially explains that he went to go see The Witch because, of course, I was praising it. And he said, I was totally right with it. It's not your normal horror movie, and it was slower than you would expect, but I loved it. He didn't particularly like it, and he said that the general consensus of the theater was that they didn't like it as well. Even though I was accurate on my review of describing it being a slow burn, and the language is a challenge to get through in the movie, and the attention to detail was spot on, and it was a different take on the horror genre. He just didn't particularly like it. And that's fair. I mean, there's a lot of people out there who didn't particularly like this movie. In fact, go on to like Flickster or Rotten Tomatoes or IMDb. Read some of the negative reviews of this one from audience members. Although it did pretty well. I mean, we'll talk about that in the box office, but it did above expectations. And I guess part of it, before I get into answering his question, part of it is The Witch, it's a real hard sell to just the mainstream audience because it's not just, people hear horror movie and they think, oh, it's going to be scary. Don't judge horror movies on whether or not they're scary. There's a lot of horror movies I love that don't scare me one bit. I mean, Dracula, the original Dracula is not scary at all to me. in 2016, watching it as a 44-year-old man, it's not scary. It was scary back in 1931 when it was made, but, you know, it's a very different movie. And horror movies just don't have to scare you. They don't have to just make you feel uneasy. If you want to see a movie about people feeling uneasy, club some puppies on camera and then make a movie out of it. That's going to make people really uncomfortable. I'm not saying that's going to make a good movie or even be ethical, so please don't do that. So, yes, there is a disconnect right now, and I think that that happens. And David's question is about the disconnect. He sent me this actually detailed spreadsheet about how often through Rotten Tomatoes, the critics versus the users, you know, how close they're in agreement. Because sometimes they're right on, you know, just a couple percentage points off. Sometimes they're 40% away from each other. And he's a math geek. He's a math teacher. So, of course, this is how he framed it. So here's his question. When you review a movie, are you doing it as a film critic by looking at things that a screenwriter or film school graduate student would look for? Or do you review the film on how much enjoyment that a normal person would get out of the film? Listening to your reviews, you seem to bounce between the two. Are you surprised by the variance between critics and users for The Witch and other films from last year that showed the largest difference? Well, first of all, critics, by their nature, view movies differently than your average person. And that's because they see all the movies or should see as many or as close to all the main releases as they can. They see everything, whether they want to or not. Regular audiences only see movies that they're interested in because they're using it as entertainment. And why would you choose stuff you didn't want to see? That's just a dumb reason to, you know, why? Who'd go to a movie and say, well, I hate romantic comedies, but I'm going to go see this romantic comedy? You know, critics have to do this as a critic, and you should, as a critic, see everything. You see, if you don't like dramas, you got to see dramas. If you don't like science fiction, you got to see science fiction. You got to see what you like and what you don't like, and it changes your barometer. So if all you see are movies that you are interested in, which is your average person, because that makes sense, there's a whole slew of movies you're not even going to touch. You're not even going to pretend to try and go see. So you tend to reassess things differently. And as a critic, because you've seen so many movies and all these different genres and types, like, if you didn't like The Witch all that much, you can be like, well, there's a lot in it that's really good, but there's way worse. And so when I see people say, this was the worst movie I ever saw, I'm like, you haven't seen all the movies this year. So I always try to view it as an audience member, just as myself, you know, would I like it if I saw it on my own without this being my job? But I still see all the fast food movies, and sometimes when you see so many fast food movies, the more acquired taste films tend to grow on you because they're different than just the very formulaic. I mean, if you're like me, I see 30 to 50 movies a month, sometimes more. You know, when you see that many, you do sort of get a little tired of some of the formula. And so when there's something different or unique, it actually is quite appealing. I said last week with The Witch, I'm like, this is a hard sell for some audiences. It's a different movie. Now, I think it's going to live. I really do. I think this is going to live. And in today's world, in a Cinemaplex, and I've heard tons of horror stories about people going to movies and people are fidgeting or talking through the slow parts or checking their phones, and that can be annoying. Whereas this is one of those movies that actually I was fortunate enough to see in a quiet, very empty theater. And that certainly helped the experience. In terms of the trends, you see a general correlation for most movies, but there's a couple times where you don't. And I think you can fit them into more categories that aren't terribly quantifiable, you know, from a mathematical perspective. But generally, if there's stuff that has a political or religious angle to it, like American Sniper, War Room, Max, and Unbroken, I saw on the list, had a huge disconnect. That's usually when you see that, because critics tend to be a little more liberal, and all the people going to see American Sniper were tend to be red state people. You know, movies with particular audiences in mind, like a chick flick, or even like African-American directed ones, 50 Shades of Grey, The Perfect Man, The Longest Ride. These were all that were very targeted audiences. They didn't care what the critics had to say. Cheap comedies, stuff like Paul Blart 2 or Pixels, which wasn't like inexpensive, but it was sort of seen as this mainstream comedy. Vacation is another one where you see certain disconnect on just dumb comedies that generally don't play well with critics, or movies that have a different or artistic angle. Something like Trainwreck had a huge difference. Into the Woods, Unfriended, which was just different because it was a different take on found footage. And Ricky and the Flash and The Gift, these are ones that were slightly different and slightly outside of the mainstream, so the mainstream numbers were suppressed a little bit. I hope that answers your question, and thanks for writing in. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk real quickly about the box office. We're running out of time here. Last week, as most people predicted and as I predicted, Deadpool re-won the box office. It had $56 million. I said 65. Now, it dropped more than 50%, which means the legs probably aren't going to drive it all the way into March, but that's still great. Risen came in at, as expected, around $12 million, actually a little bit higher. That did well. The Witch did a lot better, close to $9 million when they were expecting, you know, 70% of that. And then Race did the more expected $7.5 million. This week, I think Deadpool's going to win again. The new movies aren't really putting up much of a fight, but I think Deadpool's going to be $23 million or so. It's going to drop more than 50% again. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now's the time to roll into the world-famous home cinema roundup. The big one this week is The Good Dinosaur, which is a charming little movie. Got a bum rap because it wasn't as Pixar's or the other Pixar movies, but it's just beautiful, and it's a sweet movie. It doesn't have as wide of an appeal as most Pixar movies do in terms of getting the adults in there, but I still thought The Good Dinosaur is very charming. Spotlight is also out there. That is, of course, the Oscar-nominated film. Great movie, one of the best of the year. Then, of course, on TV, you've got Fargo Season 2, and then Jesus of Nazareth, the miniseries from Franco Zeffirelli, coming out through Shout Factory. The time for Easter is coming, so, of course, not only can you see Risen in the movie theaters, but you can also get Jesus of Nazareth in the season of Lent leading up to Easter. It's a solid representation of the biblical story, a miniseries, so it runs a little long, obviously, but Jesus of Nazareth is out on Blu-ray for the first time. That's it for this week. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about London Has Fallen, Zootopia, and Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.